6 seconds to go. Comes in to Tucker. Ewing sets a screen. The shot is off. Loose ball. Ewing goes up. The basket counts.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Strick and Roll. This is episode 11. I'm your host, Shwenifu, as always. And I am joined today by the Commander-in-Chief, Dictator-in-Charge, the Supreme Commander of the Strickland, Alex Wolf. Alex, how are you doing?
I'm good. I feel like an enormous weight has been lifted off my shoulders today. With the ending of the Knicks season, I was so excited. I don't know if I've ever been more excited for a Knicks season to end than this one.
I feel exactly the same, which is why we needed to talk about the Knicks today. No, I mean, it's just, you know.
No, I mean, it was time for a post-mortem. I'm glad to finally be able to do the post-mortem.
Exactly. It was just such a – the thing is, like, the last half of the season – it just felt like we were arguing the same stuff over and over again because there was nothing else to argue. Like, there was no point where Tibbs changed the starting lineup significantly and we had some different, like, stuff to analyze. It was just the same things, right? So it's like, starter suck, bench comes in, bench good. And the only things that really changed were, like, IQ shot a lot better, Obi picked up his play of the year. But, like, those guys were good at the start of the year. They had a little blip in the middle. Like, I don't think it was as crazy of a leap as it seemed. Maybe quickly is probably more so just because the playmaking advanced so much. But before we get into all of this, I do need to announce that Strickland has a Patreon. You can subscribe to it. There's a number of tiers. There's a $6 tier that gets you access to Bod Strickland every Friday that I do with Prez. It also gets you access to the mailbag that I do every other week with Jeremy and Drew. Furthermore, you get access to the Strickland Discord, where we talk about the Knicks all the time, all day, 24/7, 365, and other things like how good is Rick Ross. There's also further tiers. There's a $9 tier that gets you access to this pod right here, Strick and Roll. It also gets you access to, more importantly, wonderful weekly articles by Jack Huntley and Matthew Miranda, two of the best in the business. In basketball, in the NBA Knicks verse. There are further tiers beyond that. There's a $15 tier, $30 tier, $50 tier, and $100 tier. You get additional benefits like discounts on merchandise. You can watch games with us, live watch parties, not this year anymore, sadly, but next year. And you could even potentially host a podcast one day. Whether you choose to subscribe or not, your support is appreciated. None of this would be possible without you. And without further ado, so look, Knicks season is obviously over, and there's a lot of ways to discuss this. But I guess, you know, like, zooming out, forgetting the arguments over minutiae, I guess not minutiae, but details. Look, they went 37-45. I think they end up with a minus 0.2 net rating on the season. Their expected win loss was 41-41, so they finished, you know, four games below what the point differential says. I kind of feel like, as annoying as Tibbs was this year, and as frustrating as that, so much has been very frustrating about this year, I think they're actually in a fine position. Like, if there is a concern, it's that, what do you do with Julius? Obviously, that's one. But the overarching concern, and this will be there until one of the young guys takes a major leap or, you know, they make a move. But, like, there still doesn't seem to be that central, like, this is our star player that we know 100% is good enough to build around. And if we build around him properly, we will have a contender. And I think, like, that would have even been the case if Randall repeated his play from last year, Like, I think we agree on this. I think most people would agree on this, was that Randle was never going to be the guy on a title team, but, like, maybe he could be one of the guys. And, look, maybe he bounces back. I don't know. But either way, I don't think that ever changed. So, you know, like, it's really nice to see these young guys develop the way they have over the course of the year. But ultimately, I think that's kind of where there's a little bit of how do we get to that place, right? How do we get that player? And I think that's, if there's a concern, that's the concern. But, like, in relation to past Knicks seasons and past iterations of this team where you're looking for that guy, they're in a much healthier position because they actually have young guys that are good, like, actually good. I mean, like, genuinely move the needle. So it's not all doom and gloom.
Yeah, I'm with you. Like, you know, I don't think they're in a bad place at all either. You know, they've managed to build all this up without sacrificing any draft capital. Like, the pick that they traded for Cam Reddish this year was so heavily protected that it was going to be a late first round pick anyway. And, like, I think you and I talked about this, I think on Pod Strickland at one point, like, the Cam trade was totally cool. You know, I don't think that there was any real downside to that. You know, I think that he has a ton of potential, and, you know, he's just one of now, like, almost 8 to 10, you know, like Leon Rose said, what was his number? Like, 9 of the 15 guys on the roster are under 24 yesterday. But
he did the Tibbs thing too, of like, and Julius is only 27.
Yeah. which is, you know, stupid, but, like, it, only in the prime of his career, and just had a big decline after the best year of his career, but, you know, whatever. But yeah, I mean, I like where they're at as far as roster construction goes. I mean, I think one other promising thing, in addition to seeing, like, these young guys are good and can play, you know, like, as much as I loved, like, which I'll get to the point I was about to make in a second, but I was just going to say, like, you know, the Knicks have had quote unquote young talent on the roster before, but it used to be in past years that was, like, all the potential of, you know, the body, but not body of work of, like, Kevin Knox, who's got an NBA body, but just hasn't put it together yet. And, like, Frank Ntilikina, who's got an NBA body, just hasn't put it together yet, you know? And, you know, I loved Frank Ntilikina. I still think that he could be an effective role player in the NBA.
Probably the greatest player of all time.
Maybe the greatest player of all time. Also, if things continue on their current slow, slow trajectory, he'll be the best player by the time he's about 55. But, like, you know, I still believe in him to a degree. Knox, maybe not so much. But, you know, we used to have to talk ourselves into these guys, whereas now there's, like Obi Toppin, Emmanuel Quickly, you know,
Quentin. Well, it's like those guys, I think, like, the upside, at least by, like, what, year three with those guys was more like, and I still think this is the Frank, like, I think, like, being a solid rotation player. Mm-hmm. Like, can you be a solid rotation player? And, like, I know that's, like, when you draft somebody in the lottery, you are always hoping for more than that, right? But, like, ultimately, if you get any, like, most of the time, if you just look at, like, average outcomes by draft slot, if you get anybody out of the top five who ends up being a solid rotation player, that's basically a hit.
Yeah, that's a win.
Yeah, that's a win. So, like, but the thing that's really exciting about these guys, and I think this is where you were going with it, is that, like, it seems like there's a lot more there. I mean, with Quickly especially, I've probably been, like, it's either me and Stacey, I think, have, like, changed places, where last year he was the most insane Quickly booster, and now I'm just like, no, I'm the captain now. But, like, I like, with Quickly and with Obi, like, they're already good rotation players, if not more than that, like, in their second years in the NBA. And yes, Obi's older, and sure, Quickly is 22, and he spent 2 years in college, but, like, I don't really give a shit. Like, they're already contributing at a level where, at this stage in their careers, if they're already doing that, there is a very good reason and, honestly, likelihood that they develop into just more than simply nice rotation players.
Yeah, I'm with that. Like, I think that is exactly where I was going. Like, I think, you know, there's more than just potential with these guys. There's, like, actual realized results here. And, you know, you could say all you want, like, oh, Kevin Knox scored 30 in his rookie year or whatever. Like, yeah, sure, cool. But you never saw anything out of Kevin Knox that looked anything close to what Obi's doing right now, in the sense of, like, Knox always looked like he was sort of a fish out of water. Like, he was just kind of like thrown into the fire without, you know, any clothes on, you know. It was just like, figure it out, dude. Like, you know, like it was like Kevin Knox was like out on an episode of Naked and Afraid, and like Obi Toppin looks more like he's on an episode of Survivor, man. You know what I mean? Like, Obi just looks more equipped to actually replicate what he's been doing, and to like actually survive in the NBA. And I think that, you know, that definitely informs, you know, how you can look at the Knicks going forward, because now they have these guys that give them the ability to either grow together and just try to see if it works out, you know, try to pull like the, I don't know if you want to call it the Warriors method initially, the, you know, the OKC method, whatever you want to call it, where you just see like, hey, you know, we've seen flashes out of these guys. Maybe they can turn into a really winning core together. Or if they decide to, you know, just go for the splash, they have the pieces to make that splash now, like legitimately. Like, it's not like we're just talking ourselves into like, oh, some team will talk themselves into Kevin Knox as like the centerpiece of a trade with a couple first round picks for like Damian Lillard. It's like, no, like if you're giving up like Obi Toppin and Emmanuel Quickley in a deal now, or even just one of them, that's a significant piece. You know, those are two guys that have now proved that they can be like 20 point per game scorers in the NBA potentially, with how they've played over these last few weeks, and honestly how they played the whole season and just weren't really given chances to do more by Tibbs, which I'm sure we're going to talk about in this show too. But, you know, I feel pretty good about the Knicks going forward. I think they're well equipped. They have all their own picks. They still have the extra Dallas pick next year, which I think holds more value as a theoretical asset than an actualized asset. So we'll see how they can kind of leverage the value of like what like future picks mean in the NBA in like this upcoming season. But I like where they're going. You know, I still have faith regardless of how many times Leon Rose opens his mouth and speaks to a camera or who he does it with. You know, the actions and the, you know, what the front office has done and how they've drafted, how they spent their money, how they've guarded the draft picks still, which has been, you know, honestly, it's crazy to say, but it's been a core tenet of the last three Knicks front offices at this point to guard draft picks with their lives.
I don't think I'm not revealing any state secrets here. That's like basically been a tenet of theirs, because when Dolan did that entire, McKinsey do like that fucking analysis of the franchise before he hired Phil, after he fired Grunwald, like during that 2013-14 season. And I'm pretty sure they just had consultants that told him like, yeah, so what you want to do is not constantly trade your first round picks. That's going to be what you want to do. And if you actually notice since then, like, even the onerous, like, horrible contracts the Knicks have given out, they are not in the same ilk as the ones of, like, the 2000s, I don't think. I mean, like, really, if you're talking about true disaster contracts, the only one that I would say qualifies as that after the 2013-14 season is the Noah contract. Like, that's it. Like, I don't think any other contract they've handed out is a disaster. And when I say disaster, I mean like crippling your franchise. You know, like Courtney Lee was annoying. I didn't think that was a franchise crippler. Tim Hardaway Jr. was annoying. I don't think that's a franchise crippler. Obviously, you know, I don't want to relitigate the Porzingis trade, but they were able to move those contracts in that trade, clear off the cap space. Did Leon Rose and Brock Oller and these guys nail last year's offseason? No, they didn't. Like, it's fine. Like, that's just a fact. They did not do it. But none of these contracts to me are ones that I look at and I'm like, man, this is going to sink the franchise for the foreseeable future. Like the Randall contract is weird. I tend to not think it's, I don't think it's like a value anymore, but I don't think it's also bad. Like, I just think it is, it exists in some kind of capacity. And if you look around the NBA, there's a lot of contracts that it's hard to know if they're actually good or bad or whatever. Like, is Terry Rozier's contract good or bad? I have no idea. Like, is there a world where they would trade Rozier's contract for Randall's? Probably, maybe. I'm not saying that's going to happen. I'm just saying it's possible. Gordon Hayward for Randall, probably. Like, there's contracts out there that you can, like, envision being swapped for Julius's. And I just don't think that like qualifies him as an albatross. And that's not really to defend them as much as it's just to like point out a difference. And yeah, like, you know, Fournier's contract, I don't think it's that big of a deal. Like, I think if they were desperate to move off it this offseason, they could do it. I mean, it might cost them a pick if they just wanted to salary dump it. But like, I don't think it would be something where teams would be like, oh my God, can't even imagine trading for this deal.
Yeah, I would argue that he arguably played up to his deal in like the second half of the season. You know, the first half was rough, but the second half when he finally settled in, I thought that he did everything that we expected him to do.
Yeah, no, I 100% agree. And I just, you know, I don't think, and like to go to your point, like it's actually kind of funny to me thinking of the criticisms of this current front office. Because a lot of the criticisms that we've read, and I think Jake Fisher had this in his article probably a month ago about Tibbs staying on, was that one of the criticisms of this front office was like, oh, you know, they're trying to win every deal. They're never trying to make a fair deal. They're always trying to get a second round pick here, a second round pick there. And like, you know, it's like almost describing them as hoarders. And I think that's really interesting because it's just like the exact opposite of what the criticism and the shortcomings of the Knicks was for so long, right? It was so much of like not valuing draft picks, not understanding how to acquire more capital, how to not use leverage in trade talks and stuff like that. And does that mean like, yes, there's obviously a threshold where you get like, you know, Leon was on there yesterday and he talked about how they have 13 draft picks over the next 3 years, I think he said, four first round picks. And like that's getting to that point where you're like, okay, it's great that we have all these picks, but like we probably need to start consolidating them or trading a second for like converting it to a second down the line from like another team or something, but just like pushing out your assets. But the fact that they even have those options and stuff like that, like that's kind of why I don't think the situation is so dire or anything. Like, you know, people talk about like, how are they going to move Nerlens Noel's contract? This is why you acquire all these second round picks or shit like that. So that if you really need to dump him, you can just be like, all right, look, we're going to toss you like 3 seconds in this contract. Like, just give us an expiring and we all move on with our lives. You know, like there's just ways to that they have available to them now in trade that like, even if we all, I think we can all agree to some degree, that this season did not go as expected and the contracts they gave out were not universally lived up to, right? I think Burks probably lived up to his contract. Fournier probably lived up to his contract. Rose did when he was healthy, but obviously the health is a big question mark. Kemba, a dud. Noel, a total dud. And Randall, let's just be honest. Like for right now, I don't think the contract is untradeable or anything like that. Not even close. But relative to what you were expecting, he was a dud this year. But like now, let's see what you can do. You have all these salaries. Now it's up to you as the front office. And, you know, the pressure is on them even more. I tweeted this out today, but like retaining Tibbs puts the pressure on them even more to convert these salaries in some capacity into a more productive and useful rotation. Not that this year's rotation was necessarily bad or devoid of talent, but like there's obviously upgrades to be made. You know, you can always improve from where they are right now. But I'm very interested to see how they go about it because like I said, you know, and Leon mentioned this, like they have the 13 draft picks over the next 3 drafts, 4 of them being first rounders. And he specifically mentioned that like it gives them flexibility to be players in a lot of different areas, which obviously given contracts is probably traits. So I'm very curious to see how they go about things this offseason.
Yeah, I am too. You know, I think that they're unfortunately, at least as of right now, I mean, things can change after the playoffs, obviously. But as of right now, they're sort of in this weird spot where they're in a perfect position to make a star trade without any stars really making that much noise that they're ready to move on from where they are right now. You know, it's like there's the guys that, you know, the Knicks will always sort of be linked to in some way or another are the Leon Rose former clients. And that's like Karl Anthony Towns, who's about to, you know, be in the play-in. And that's like the first time that the Timberwolves have made any sort of playoff appearance since Tibbs was there. And he might not be super thrilled to come and play with Tibbs again, even though things seem to be kind of smoothed over with him. Like Joel Embiid, who's on the Sixers, who kind of just went all in with this James Harden trade And I doubt that Embiid's then going to turn around and be like, trade me now. You know, he's going to give it at least a year's worth of chance. Devin Booker, who's on like literally the best team in the league, is never going to ask out of there. And that brings you to like Donovan Mitchell, who maybe is the most likely guy to ask out, but you know, he's been in a fairly good situation too. And unfortunately is going to have like four more years left on his contract after this year. So it's like, how much leverage does he really have to get where he wants to go? You know, it's just interesting to see what the Knicks end up doing. You know, it's like, because to your point, yes, some things need to change, but they do have sort of the blueprint and the pieces to potentially make that big trade to sort of move them to the next level or something. Or they could just sort of reshuffle things a little bit. And like, I don't think I know that you and I and many other fans are unhappy with the fact that it seems like they're going to keep Tibbs at least to start next year based off how things went this year. But, you know, there's some moves that could be made by the front office that, you know, however unfortunate they would be, because it would mean sort of jetting some pretty good players that you simply have to jet just to take them away from Tibbs, like Alec Burks or something. But there is a scenario where the Knicks could just kind of jet Julius Randle, jet, you know, Alec Burks and a couple of these other like security blanket type players for Tibbs, and just like, you know, maybe they re-sign Mitch to a somewhat reasonable contract, and then, you know, ink RJ to an extension, which I don't care what anybody says, if they ink him to like a rookie max extension, that is not a stupid move. That is just a move where you're betting on the guy and you're trying to tell him that you have faith in him and the work that he's put in and everything else, and might even motivate for a guy like RJ. I think that would motivate him to be even better, more so than like what we saw with Julius, where it seems like getting a big contract puts pressure on him, which then it can sometimes make him fold, like he did his first year here and like he did this year after inking the big extension. They're in a good spot. They're you know, they have the requisite salaries to put together a star trade should one become available. They have the requisite young pieces to include as sort of the immediate gratification in those deals. They have at least one extra, you know, first round pick and like a ton of extra second round picks to add in as that pick, you know, gratification for any given deal that they would do. So I think they're very well positioned. It's just, you know, this offseason will be one of the first ones where I'll say, like, you know, last year was an aberration. Nobody thought the Knicks were going to make the four seed. Clearly it was an aberration in the way that Julius played and stuff, because I think the real answer for him is, I don't know if he's necessarily the guy that we saw this year. If you can get him happy and motivated and willing and all that stuff, I think it's probably a middle ground of what we saw last year versus what we saw this year, as far as leveling out his efficiency, certainly leveling out his attitude, stuff like that. But, you know, last year, like I said, it was an aberration. They had what we thought was going to be a huge offseason this past year, where they might be able to make a leap into like actual semi-contention. Obviously, that was not the case. And, you know, Julius crashed back to earth. And, you know, Tibbs regressed, I think, in many ways, in the way that he coached the team and his willingness to adapt and things like that. And we sort of saw the team just sort of crumble based off where they were last year. Now, though, if things have been different, like Derek Reifer wrote this in a recap at Strickland recently, and I really agreed with it. He was like, what if things didn't work out the way they did last season? What if it, you know, the Knicks went from being as bad as they were in 19-20 to then last year being like a, I don't know, like 12 games under 500 or something, or like 10 games under 500 in the condensed season, to then this year, you know, putting up the year that they did, and they ended up, what was it, eight games under 500 for the year, and like sort of on the cusp of the play-in in many ways. You know, how would we be looking at this? And we'd probably be saying, okay, yeah, incremental improvements, this is cool. Maybe Julius wouldn't be signed to the contract that he is now, but that might be one of the only differences, because they might have still tried to make those same moves last year with adding shooting with Evan Fournier and things of that nature, or adding guys that could do more than shoot with Fournier over Bullock, stuff like that. Those are all just kind of common sense moves. So I think if you take last season out of the equation, which it's impossible to, you know, like it does exist, but if you sort of looked at it through that lens, I think they're doing all right, but this would still be a very pivotal offseason, no matter how last season went, because now is the time where the expiration date's coming soon on some of these like young value centric contracts, you know, like the guys on their first round pick deals, the guys on the second round pick deals, like Mitch, you know, is going to need to potentially get paid this year. You have to make that big decision. You have to figure something out with Cam Reddish next year, who you invested something in this year. You know, this is going to be the pivotal offseason where they have to sort of pick a lane and stick to it. And I think it's also going to be a pivotal offseason where, you know, this might be the first time that Leon Rose has to approach Tibbs and be like, look, man, I respect your autonomy as head coach of this team, but we're going to need to see certain things this coming year because we have big decisions we need to make. And you know, we need your help to make those decisions. And if you're not willing to offer that, then our time might be up sooner than later. So we'll see how that all goes. But hopefully Leon approaches it with that sort of mindset.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is kind of why I just am really frustrated by the decision to keep Tibbs, because I don't see he's not going to change. Like, this is what he is. He's not going to do a bunch of different things now. There are things about him that will never change, right? Like, I do think he is adapted in certain ways, right? Like as a very basic example, shooting more threes this year, right? Like, he understands, like, you've got to shoot more threes to kind of move the needle offensively. And he understands that. So it's not like he's, like, unaware that the game evolves and moves. But, like, there are core things about him that will never change. He is never going to genuinely try playing Julius and Obi together, right? And maybe Julius is going to get traded, so it doesn't matter in the short term. But, like, that always is going to matter because it tells you something about him, that he is not willing to adapt and to try things outside of what he feels are the right, quote unquote, the right way to play, right? He's never going to. And that is just such a challenge. And then you have stuff like what other coach in the NBA would go this long this season playing Alec Burks at point over Quickley? Even if at some point in time you were like, you know what, I don't think Quickley's ready to start right now. So Burks is going to have to bite the bullet and we'll just see how things go. At a certain point this year, it became very fucking obvious that Quickley was better than Burks at point guard and should play over him and start over him. And that adjustment never came. It never came. Just like last year, we sat there for an entire season like, why is Elfrid Payne still starting? Why is Elfrid Payne still starting? Why is Elfrid Payne still starting? And then finally we get to the playoffs and it's so obvious, and it's at the point where, like, you can't afford to lose those minutes anymore, that he finally benched Elfrid Payne. But that's what it took. Like, that is such an insane degree of either arrogance or self-delusion. It doesn't really matter which one, because whichever way it is, that's not reflective of, like, good coaching. And this year we saw the same shit play out with Quickley, and more disgustingly and more absurdly with Obi. I mean, the Obi stuff this year was as criminal a coaching decision that could possibly exist. Because he created this binary mindset of, like, it's either Randall or Obi. Like, because we can't ever play them together. So it's just, we have 48 minutes of the four, and it's one of those two guys, and that's what it is. And he created that. That was not, like, forced on him. There are plenty of coaches. I would venture to guess the vast majority of coaches at this point in the NBA would have played Obi and Randall together pretty consistently. I'm not saying, like, 15 minutes a game together, but, like, five to 8 minutes a game of those guys on the floor together. Like, I think a lot of coaches would do that. And I definitely think a lot of coaches would do that situationally to close games and stuff like that. And the fact that he never did that, it capped Obi's minutes, and then it creates this mindset of, like, well, it has to be one or the other, so what do you expect me to do? Of course I'm going to play the guy who was All-NBA last year, was All-Star last year, was Most Improved Player last year. Like, it's just stupid. Like, and even if he wanted to only play one of those guys at all times, the skew of minutes was always so ridiculous. Like, it was ridiculous for Obi to only, like, I have to look this up again, but I'm almost positive that Obi, I know when I checked last week it was the case, Obi averaged less minutes per game this year than Nerlens Noel and Taj Gibson. That is a joke. Like, I know that they're not effectively playing the same positions, but again, that's because of how Tibbs coaches. He creates this binary mindset where it's like, well, those guys play the five and Obi plays the four, so no, it's not the same. But the fact that those guys average more minutes than Obi just shows the limitation of his approach. Like, yeah, Obi averaged 17.1 minutes per game this year, Nerlens was at 22.5 and Todd was at 18.2. Like,
yeah, it's just obscene.
That's and obscene.
And here's something kind of interesting too, right? Like, I feel like I don't know. I mean, this is kind of like just coming to me. I haven't really thought about this too much, but as you were saying that with the binary thing, it also sort of, I mean, I feel like it's been underexamined that the way that Tibbs handled those two players might have in some way affected Julius's clear, like, mindset issues this year. You know what I mean? Like, it's Julius versus the fan favorite, you know, and that's how it was made out to be by Tibbs via the rotation. It was like, you know, it's either going to be Obi playing or Julius. And so Julius would have like a little bit of an off, you know, half or whatever. And then you start hearing the Obi Toppin chants and, you know, the huge cheers when he checks in, because fans know that, like, you're never going to see him and Julius together. So then Julius is, in his mind, is thinking like, oh, once if the fans are cheering for Obi, that means that they want me out, you know, and Obi's, you know, then having to deal with like, oh, I'm directly replacing Julius. And, you know, Obi, like, to his credit, even was saying as of like yesterday or maybe after Friday's game, I forget, he made a lot of comments between the two games because obviously he got a lot of airtime. But like he said after the one game, like, you know, I really want to play with Julius and see what we can do together. And, you know, I'm sure that he means that earnestly, like, because the few times they were allowed to play together just out of sheer necessity, like earlier in the season when it literally won the Knicks games when they played together, they played really well. And it actually seemed to increase, you know, Julius's effort level too in some ways, because Obi is the outlet pass receiving master and Julius is actually a pretty damn good outlet pass maker. In transition and stuff. So it's just like, I don't know. I feel like it's been sort of, I feel like we haven't examined this enough. And of course now we have a whole off season to examine it and think about this sort of stuff. But I think there is something to be said with the way that, like you said, and like, I know Jeff Rasmussen, you know, Frank Barrett, you know, said this all year in recaps and, you know, on podcasts and stuff too. And a number of other people have said it, but like, you know, Tibbs has this very rigid way of looking at things where it's one or the other, and guys have their assigned positions and assigned roles that cannot be deviated from. And so because Obi was a power forward and Julius was a power forward, there could never be a scenario where both of them could be on the floor at the same time, because in Tibbs's mind, that's just like physically impossible. Even though we literally saw Julius for stretches handle pure centers pretty well, just by his sheer, like, Julius, I'll say this much, like, you might look at this like almost as him being lackadaisical on defense in some ways, but his unwillingness to bite on defense, you know, as far as like biting on fakes and stuff, which some might see as like, oh, he should be like more active in getting up to contest or whatever, but against certain guys, all they want to do is pump fake you to death, like Sabonis or something, and Randall would never take that. And actually defended those guys quite well as a result, because he wouldn't fall for all the fakes and would just kind of keep his hands up and disrupt the guy. And Obi showed, especially towards the end of the season, a little bit of rim protection, particularly like coming out of nowhere to try to provide like a block at the last moment or something like that. So it was very easy to see a blueprint where those two could work together in stretches. And yet Tibbs just kind of refused to try it. And then to your point, it created this binary that I think, you know, more so than even just what it did on the court, I think might have been some of the cause of some of the, you know, the off court and I guess in some ways on court in the way that Julius played and stuff, but some of these divisions between like Julius and the fans and Julius and it seems like the coaching staff and the team, because we've heard all these reports about him potentially wanting out, you know, based off how things were handled this season with him and all that. So, you know, I don't think that can be under stress, you know what I mean? That the Tibbs might have played a hand in that as well.
Yeah. It's to me, it's just like I think what's really frustrating with Tibbs is like, I don't think he's a bad development coach. I've said this on like about 5,000 pods and in many, many tweets. Like, I don't think he's a bad development coach. I think he really fucking sucks though at trusting the guys he's developing at points in time where it's obvious that he needs to, that he should trust them. You know, like, it was so obvious by January that Quickly was significantly better than Kemba Walker. Like, not like marginally not, you know, he had his days. It was like consistently, game by game, you knew that Quickly would outperform Kemba, whether he fucking shot well or not. You know, it is what it is. So it's like, I don't know what to do with that. Like, because to me, I do, like, what is frustrating for me is seeing people being like, well, see, all the kids are playing well now, so clearly Tibbs was a master of development for them. And I don't like to take away from whatever he has done to aid their development, not in terms of time on the court necessarily, but like things that are happening in practice and all this shit behind the scenes that we don't get to see day by day. There's a few things here, right? There are specific development coaches, right? This is not like Tibbs by himself, like having individual sessions with each of these young guys, you know, every single day. Like, no, we have development coaches for that purpose. A lot of these guys, like Sims and Deuce specifically, they spent a lot of time in the G League. So, like, they were working separate from the big Knicks. Like, they got a lot of their playing time and reps and all that stuff somewhere else. And on top of that, like, I don't know how I'm supposed to just trust his, like, talent ID when it's obvious, like, Obi wasn't going to get any type of extended run until Julius sat. And the moment that happened, look at what he's done. You know, dismiss the competition and all that kind of stuff as much as you want, but, like, he's played really, really well. And he's openly talked about how, like, it's like he doesn't feel like he doesn't have to look over his shoulder every time he makes a mistake. And I just think that, like, if he never gets to that point where he's able to trust his own ability to develop players, that's a really big problem. I mean, it's actually really weird with him because, like, I actually think when he's been forced to just play a lot of young guys because of injuries and being shorthanded or whatever, he shows a lot more creativity. And, like, I don't think he's a bad coach for young players, even if he's a bit of a psycho with, like, his screaming and all that shit, but I don't care about that. Like, I think he's, like, a pretty, he's, like, these guys all have gotten better on defense, which says something about him, right? Like Obi, his biggest concern coming out of college was how bad his defense was. And I think, however, whoever is most responsible for that, I mean, the player should always get the majority of credit for development, but, like, obviously they need help along the way. And Tibbs has obviously provided a template or like a structure for them to improve defensively, especially, that he deserves credit for. But like, if I have to create a roster in such a fashion where you have to play the guys that I want you to play, and I can't just trust you to play the right guys, that is a really big problem for me. Like, if I'm Leon Rose and I'm in somebody in the front office, that's a really big problem. And look, it seems like Leon, what I'm getting the sense of is that, like, I think it's pretty obvious that Wes and Brock are done with Tibbs. And I think Leon is more of like the, hey, look, like, not everything was great this year, but Tibbs did a great job the year before. And, you know, we fucked up a few things, so we're going to give him another year. That's what it seems like to me anyway. I don't think it's like a resounding endorsement of Tibbs, but I do think it's more of like a, let's give it another, a little bit more time and see what happens. And let's see if Tibbs can change. But again, to go back to it, that puts the onus on the front office to create a roster in such a way that it will force Tibbs to play the guys that you want him to play. And I just don't understand, like, how that's conducive to what you ultimately want to do. You know, like, it sucks that we have to sit here and shit on Alec Burks when, like, Burks is a good player. And I think he's been awesome for the Knicks. Like, I've talked about this before, but, like, you can argue that in the last 20 years, if you look at all of the Knicks' free agent expenditures, he's, like, the one guy who they've signed who's probably, and they've signed him to multiple contracts now, who's really, like, provided value on those deals. And obviously, the Knicks' free agent history isn't exactly littered with great success. But you get my point, is, like, he should actually be seen as a success story for himself and for the Knicks and for this organization. But, like, instead, because of how Tibbs has chosen to deploy him beyond all reason, you just become frustrated by it, you know? So it is, you know, it is what it is. I just, it's really, really frustrating to kind of, to really just see how things have unfolded with Tibbs this year. But, you know, look, I don't want to get, we've talked about Tibbs endlessly. We've talked about the front office.
Let me just interject real quick. I just want to say, I too like Alec Burks in his role as a fourth guard on a good team. In the playoffs, he will get exposed as a point guard trying to run a team. But I too like him in his role. No, I'm with you, though. Like I said that on Locked On Knicks like a million times this year. Like it's unfortunate that now, you know, the big, you know, so if we want to sort of wrap up the Tibbs discussion on this, but like the big, it's like you said, the problem with bringing him back isn't so much that like he's the worst coach that's ever coached or whatever. Like there have been some clear things that he did well. He did get buy-in last year, you know, and he clearly had some measure of buy-in this year too. But like, no matter what anybody tells you about like, oh, the team loved him so much and like, you know, Obi or Quickly will come out and say it. You could see for most of this year, the reactions that Quickly and Obi had to getting pulled after they would put together like an 8-minute stretch of great basketball and then make one bad play and get yanked so that, you know, Kemba Walker could go out there and shit all over himself, or Julius Randle could go out there and like sulk his way to another like 8 points and 5 turnovers to end the game. You know what I mean? Like you could see that they were clearly not like thrilled with the entire situation, with how Tibbs was handling things, regardless of what they might say. And, you know, I hope that the front office also wasn't thrilled.
I agree with a lot of that, and we're going to get back to that, but I do have to say something. The NHL season has been packed with dirty dangles, hat tricks, and big wins. As the action rolls on, DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NHL, has your shot to win big too. New customers can bet just $1 on any team and get $150 in free bets if they win. That's right, a bump in the win column for your team means free bets for you. If Sportsbook isn't available in your state yet, you still have a shot to light the lamp. Everyone can play for huge cash prizes with DraftKings Daily Fantasy Hockey Contest. DraftKings is giving all new customers a free shot at millions of dollars in total prizes with their first deposit. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app now, use promo code THPN, bet just $1 on any NHL team, and get $150 in free bets if they win. That's promo code THPN at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NHL. 21 plus restrictions apply. See show notes for details, which I'm going to read to you now, and I probably shouldn't have read that part. All right. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem, crisis counseling and referral services can be accessed by calling 1-800-GAMBLER, 1-800-426-2537. That's in Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Wyoming. You can call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona, 1-800-522-4700 in Colorado or New Hampshire, 888-789-7777, or visit http://ccpg.org/chat. That's in Connecticut. 1-800-BETS-OFF, Iowa, 1-877-770-STOP, or text 7867 for LA, 877-8-HOPE-NY, or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Visit opgr.org. That's in Oregon. Call or text Tennessee Redline 1-800-889-9789 for Tennessee, or 1-800-532-3500 for Virginia. Must be 21 plus or 18 and over in New Hampshire and Wyoming. Physically present in Arizona, Colorado, Connecticut, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Louisiana, Michigan, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, Virginia, West Virginia, Wyoming. Minimum $5 deposit required. Eligibility restrictions apply. See http://draftkings.com/sportsbook for details.
Well, I don't know. Berman, actually, I don't know if you just saw this, but Berman just dropped a piece. And in it, he says, when the Knicks hit the All-Star break amid a 3-13 fall, a 3-game losing streak, and a 25-34 record, at least two members of the front office recommended that Tom Thibodeau be let go. Welcome. I think without saying it, I think we can assume that that is Worldwide West and Brock Oller. Front office members thought Thibodeau had, as one source put it, lost the team. They didn't like some of the body language and attentiveness during timeout huddles. That has to be about Julius. It says, you know, Leon was dead set against it. So obviously my powers of deduction are excellent. You know, he goes on to say this. A source said that Thibodeau earned kudos with brass for being willing to play rookie center Jericho Sims over the veterans after the break. I agree. He does deserve credit for that. And I mean that not facetiously. Like, I know that people, as soon as Sims kind of got into the mix, people were like, how was he not playing sooner? I think he was so raw to start the year. Like, he played like 2 minutes in that first Boston game and he had no idea what the hell he was doing. I think he needed the reps he got. I think it's a really big kudos to not just Tibbs, but the organization and the development structures they set up that he's made the progress he has made this year. I mean, his passing out of like catching the ball on the roll and stuff now, I'm like really impressed by it. I'm kind of like scared at what I almost think he could develop into or something at this point. I don't want to say it publicly, so I'm not going to, but his passing chops are crazy. Last thing, I'm going to throw this in there. According to one NBA source, the front office and some players weren't thrilled with how the coach handled the enigmatic Julius Randle this season in not holding him more accountable for his miscues. I think this is all very normal. This is all basically what we've been saying, right? It's like, these are just facts. This is just what happened this year. And, you know, if you want to keep Tibbs and you think he deserves another chance, I think that's fine. I strongly, vehemently disagree with it, but I don't think that's an unreasonable position to have. What I have an issue with is like not just accept that the things he did poorly this year were poor. They were really poor. And in another universe where he gets fired, it wouldn't be this unimaginable disaster. He would have deserved it. And he's lucky. He's very lucky, I think, that Leon seems to be as patient as he is, not just with him, but in general with how he operates. Because I think a lot of other front offices in this league would have watched what he did this year and fired him at the end of the season. I thought he did a really terrible job. I've been on record saying, like, I think he did a bottom five job in the league this year. I think he did a terrible job with the resources handed to him. And that's adjusting for Julius playing like an asshole and Kemba doing whatever Kemba decided to do this year. But let's switch gears a little bit. Let's talk. Look, the Knicks have more than a few decisions to make over the offseason. But probably the two biggest ones they have are related to RJ Barrett and Mitchell Robinson, two guys that are up for new contracts. RJ still has a year left on his rookie deal, but he's extension eligible this offseason. And Mitch is out of contract now. He's an unrestricted free agent. So let's just start with Mitch, actually, because I think this is actually a lot more interesting and can go in a lot of ways, more so than RJ, who I think
this will make for better conversation on the Mitch front too, because I know you and I have been at various sides of opposite sides of the aisle on Mitch for a lot of this year, so this will be interesting.
Yeah, I think even if the Knicks don't come to a contract extension this offseason with RJ, that's not really that big of a concern to me. Like, I think as long as they negotiate in good faith and make honest offers that are not like bullshit, it's fine. Like, if you offer RJ 4 years, $125 million, right? But not the full 5 year, $181 million extension, I don't think that's like a disrespectful offer, right? And that's just about like, if RJ wants to take that, cool. If not, then you'd be like, hey, look, like, we are happy to pay you next offseason. And if you want to bet on yourself, so be it. But like, we just can't get there right now. But we still like want to have you here long term. We see you as a long term piece. I don't think like there's a way. Like, look, Leon was an agent for a long time. I think he has an idea of like how to have that conversation with him, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's where it's not this offensive thing. Mitch is obviously a different case because he's an unrestricted free agent, and I'm kind of like, I'm not even really torn on this, but it's like, if there was a better center option available on the market, I would not have any hesitation in trying to make an aggressive play for them. I just don't see it. I mean, the only guy who theoretically could be on the market is somebody like DeAndre Ayton, but, you know, who the hell knows what's going on there? Like, if Sarver's being cheap, okay, then you have a chance to get him, but it's the same thing, right? Like, he's a restricted free agent, so ultimately
If the Suns want to keep him, they can keep him. And, I mean, if that's the only thing we're talking about is, like, well, DeAndre Ayton. I mean, that's one guy. That's it. Other than that, is there a center on the market that you're like, yeah, I would definitely want him over Mitch? I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think there's just, like, I guess the question then becomes, right, like, especially if you're keeping Tibbs, like, you know, he's probably going to be like, oh, can we bring Taj back for another year or whatever? And, you know, fine, like, if you want to bring him back and then say, okay, you know what, we saw enough out of Jericho Sims this year that we feel comfortable with, like, let's elevate him to starter. We'll see what we can do, and we have capable backups to kind of spell him if Nerlens Noel can get healthy, assuming that they don't just, like, salary dump him somewhere. You know, he's proven that he could be a decent backup and all that. You know, and if they bring back Taj for his, you know, millionth season in the NBA, you know, and want to have him back up Sims too, is just sort of like foul trouble insurance. You know, maybe that's a direction they go, but, or maybe even they just scour the free agent market. There's always, like, I don't have a free agent list in front of me, but there's always five, like, JaVale McGee type players available that you could sign for, like, basically the minimum that will give you, like, good center production if you want to go that route. And if they wanted to do that and say, okay, you know, we'll get a couple insurance policies on the roster behind Sims just in case, you know, like, he gets in foul trouble, which would definitely happen if you elevated Sims to starter. Like, it would be sort of like when Mitch was first trying to start, you know, in, like, his second year. There would be some foul trouble nights. There would be some nights where you'd have to really work through some issues and stuff. But, you know, I think it would be defensible if they would decide to go that route. That said, I don't know if I would necessarily go that route, because I think, like you said, like, there's not many other guys on the roster or on the market that you could be like, let me go after this guy to replace what Mitchell Robinson was giving me. And I think for as mercurial as he was at times this year, I think by the time the dust settled at the end of the year, I think that Mitch was, he was a plenty good starting center in the, and like, definitely a plus defensive guy. Still on offense, he needs to commit to learning some new stuff. You know, like, catching and dunking is cool. Offensive rebounding is great. You know, that's awesome. That's kind of, I think that's like his bread and butter at this point, is offensive rebounds for a putback dunk, which is cool. I mean, that's a super duper valuable skill in the NBA, but he needs to learn just like a little hook shot or something, or, you know, anything along those lines, a little mid-range shot, you know, which I don't think is very likely considering he can't shoot free throws worth anything. And his shooting form is just insanely bad. But, you know, even just a little hook shot, a little, you know, a little bit of a back to the basket game, something like that, just to give him a little diversity in what he can do would be super useful. But I would feel pretty comfortable giving him, I've said this whole time and I'll stick by it, I know some people disagree, say it's too high, whatever. I would feel, if it took paying him up to like what Robert Williams got, I would do it. Because I don't think that ever becomes like you said earlier in the show, that never to me becomes an albatross. That's never going to be a deal that I look at and say, oh man, like, Mitch is completely untradeable. You know, like, damn, what did the Knicks do? You know, it's, if you give him like the Jared Allen contract, then maybe there's a point where you look at it and you say, damn, like $20 million a year over 5 years, that's going to be pretty rough to move, you know, for a guy like Mitch, if he doesn't improve some things in his game. But like 4 years at like under, or I think it was under $60 million for, wasn't it like 456 for Robert Williams?
454, but I think it's actually like 448 guaranteed.
Right.
There's like $6 million incentives or something.
Right. So if you do something like that, that's like perfectly movable to me, you know, at any point during Mitch's deal. If he never improves a single thing, he's movable at that price. And some team would jump at the opportunity if they were like really short on rim protection and needed a dude like that on their team. Like if it was a team like, I don't know, Golden State or something like that, like next year, if the Knicks decide, you know, we suck again, let's get rid of Mitch by the deadline or whatever. You could trade him to a team like Golden State or something that would be like, oh, we really just want like a defensive presence. We don't need him to be a huge offensive presence other than just like cleaning up our messes, you know, but he could definitely affect things on the defensive end for us. Some team would bite and give you something, you know, it might not be a ton, but you could definitely offload him and get something in return, like an intriguing player and, you know, a second round pick or something, like, if nothing else, if not like a late first rounder for him. So I'm of the mind to extend him and give him another deal. But I don't know where you're standing on that as of right now.
I mean, like I said, I don't think there are better options. Yeah. And if the contract you have to give him is the Robert Williams contract, like, that's fine. I think where it gets dicey is, like, if there's a team that's out there willing to pay him more than that. I don't think there would be. But, like, you have Detroit sitting out there with a bunch of cap space and they don't have any idea what the fuck they're doing. And I don't mean that, like, derogatorily. I mean that in the sense of, like, they're a bad team that has a lot of different holes that they need to
You can also mean it derogatorily for the amount of money they spent on centers, like, 2 years ago. So.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was obviously bad. But, like, I guess, like, you know, they have, like, a decent young core going on there, whatever. But, like, they have money burning a hole in their pocket. And even if you were a smart team, when you have that much cap space and you have needs to fill, look, we're Knicks fans. We've seen this before. It's hard. It's hard to pay guys what they're really worth. But especially, like, a market like them, a bad team like them, they have to overpay guys to come there. And so, like, is there a world where they go, you know, maybe they go, what if they did, like, $360 million for Mitch? You know, like, is that something I'd be comfortable matching? Like, it wouldn't. It wouldn't. But at the same time, I don't understand why they would do it. That's where it gets dicey for me. Like, what if he wants 460, 465? What's the hard line here? You know, like, and the Knicks are in a tough position because he is an unrestricted free agent. So, like, ultimately, he can always dangle it out there. Like, all it takes is for Detroit to say, like, yeah, look, we're going to give you 360. If he brings that back to the Knicks, what are they going
to
say?
You know, he also doesn't even have to bring it back to the Knicks. Right. Like, that's the other thing is when you're an unrestricted free agent, you can just sign and call them later. You know, like, you could sign right on the spot and be like, all right, sorry, Knicks, peace. Like, that's what
or
I
never
wanted.
Call them.
Yeah.
Or never call them.
Or never call them.
And so, that's where it's dicey for me. When it comes down to it, though, I will say this. I don't think he actually wants to leave. I certainly don't think he actually wants to leave for Detroit. A team like Dallas, you know, they don't really have a five right now. And I know that they're doing this whole small ball thing, but you have to think somebody like Mitch would have appeal to them. Obviously, with kind of all the ball handling they have with Luka and Dinwiddie and potentially Brunson if they retain Brunson. I think it's just like an interesting fit. And he's obviously from New Orleans, so it's a closer to that region. Like, that's another team, but it's like they don't have cap space. So for him to end up in Dallas, like, would require the Knicks to play ball. And that's okay. But, like, I'm really interested to see if there are teams that don't have cap space that are interested in him and what those deals could be, you know? And I don't think there's, like, there's a world where the Knicks trade Mitch, and I don't think it's necessarily an awful thing. You know, as an example would be, like, Charlotte desperately needs a center. What if they were willing to do, like, some kind of package built around PJ Washington? You know, is that something the Knicks would do? Like, yes, they would still have, it would definitely be a big, it would hurt their defense. And I know Jericho Sims has closed the season out really well. And I do think he does certain things defensively way better than Mitch. But, like, when you're talking about overall defense, Mitch is still a better defender than him by a lot. And so I do think it would hurt them if they made a swap like that, but you would also gain flexibility to play different ways offensively, right? Like, PJ Washington has played small ball five, and I think he's got, like, legit shooting potential, which I think would be really interesting, given, you know, what is the best way to build a team around an RJ Barrett moving forward. And look, like, let's say Randall is still here. That would benefit Randall too, right? Like, playing with a guy who can spread the floor out in the front court. And so, like, I just think there are worlds where we can move on from Mitch and it doesn't hurt us. But I also accept that there are possibilities where we lose Mitch for nothing, or even if we trade him Mitch and we get something back that's decent, it ends up being a net negative trade or move. So he's really interesting to me. But, like, I think ultimately push comes shove, I'd give him the Robert Williams deal. I feel like he'd ultimately probably take that, and that's fine. I would just always be aware, like, I fundamentally do not think Mitchell Robinson is going to be the starting center for a competitive Knicks team, or any team for that matter. I just think his limitations offensively are so severe that it restricts him in that capacity a lot. But like, he's still good enough that teams will always be willing to take a chance on him, I think. The other concern with him, though, that I have, that like, and I don't know how to price this in, and I don't even know initially how to weigh it, is like, his injuries really worry me. Because he's always like flying around that out there out of control. Like, he doesn't walk. I know this sounds weird. He doesn't like walk normal. He's always kind of like wobbling side to side, you know?
Yeah, he does kind of like lumber. Like, he's got a little Frankenstein in him.
Yeah, and it's just like, it's really worrying for me because he's so nimble at times. But then you just like, I feel like he's increasingly become more lumbering. And that really worries me because it's not like you become more athletic as you get older, right? But like, is some of that because he's recovering from that foot issue he had last year, or and because he was out of shape to start the season? You know, like, there's so many unknowns with his situation that make it really difficult, I think, from the outside looking in on just like being like, what is the right thing to do? And then I'll also say this, like, I mentioned this in the pod yesterday with Stacey, but like, there is definitely some familiarity breeds contempt with Mitch for me. Like, I've seen him for 4 years, right? I know, I'm very, very well versed in what his strengths are and what his weaknesses are. And it becomes even more frustrating because it feels like he's just gotten better at his strengths and somehow worse at the things he sucks at. Like, he's a worse free throw shooter now than he was before. You know, like, he's not improved as a screen setter at all. He can't shoot, obviously, worth a lick in games. He doesn't really have any post moves to speak of. He doesn't have great hands. Like, it's just like really weird how stagnant he's been in some ways, while also like, you can still see that he's improved, but everything he's improved at is like getting better at the things that he was good at coming in from day one. So he's just, I don't know, he's a really tough case for me. Like, I am, it's, and I think some of it is being frustrated because I was super high on Mitch coming into this season, and I just felt like so thoroughly unimpressed by what he showed over the course of the year, even though he did pick it up for sure the second half of the season. There's no doubt about that. But I think push comes to shove, you got to get over your feelings. And I think if you can retain him at that Robert Williams contract, that which is the same contract, by the way, that like Wendell Carter Jr. got, I think you should do that. You should definitely be willing to.